This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca. Ira Flato is away. British authorities have arrested more than 20 people in an alleged terror plot. Police say the suspects were planning to carry liquid explosives onto as many as 10 planes and detonate them in midair. With the arrests came heightened security at airports in the UK as well as here in the United States. In this country, passengers were ordered to remove any liquids or gels, things like shampoo, toothpaste, and bottled water, from their carry-on baggage. The idea was to prevent someone from smuggling bomb-making materials onto a plane. Joining me now to talk more about whether such a plan to detonate liquid explosives is plausible is my guest, Paul Desjardins. He's an assistant professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at the University of Buffalo. He joins us by phone. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Desjardins.
Hi, Joe. Good to be with you.
And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. So, Paul Desjardins, the question that I think a lot of people have is, you know, can you carry enough explosives on board an aircraft in a carry-on bag disguised as a tube of toothpaste or a carton, you know, a bottle of shampoo to do damage to an airplane?
Well, certainly I think that's the case. And in terms of liquefied explosives, you know, there are several that have been used historically and are commonplace, you know, things like nitromethane, isopropyl nitrate, things like that. And so these are, you know, common liquefied explosives. And can you carry enough of it to do damage to a plane? I think so. I think that's the case. I don't know what type of scanning or this sort of thing that they could prevent people from bringing that on. I don't know the details of that, but certainly you could bring enough on a plane to cause damage to the plane. I think one of the questions you might want to ask, though, is if you did damage to the plane, could it be enough to bring the plane down? And I think in that case, the explosive itself, I think the answer is no. I don't think you could bring down a plane by the explosive itself. I think the thing you worry about, though, are cascading events. If you, for instance, were to rupture the fuel tank of the plane or something along those lines, and then the fuel in itself, you know, ignited and start to burn, and then things would, you know, quickly transpire and things could get very serious.
Right, right. And I want to emphasize here that we're not giving anybody instructions on how to build one of these devices.
No.
These are commonly, I mean, we're not telling anybody a secret by saying those chemicals you mentioned are explosive.
Those are commonly well known liquid explosives. I mean, those things have, yeah, I mean, anybody, if you just Googled liquid explosive, those are probably the first thing that would pop up, right?
Right, right. Well, that, I guess that makes it handier if you want to be a terrorist.
Yeah, that, I suppose so.
Unfortunately. So the other question that people have been raising is, okay, could you bring two innocuous substances on board? You know, that people say, well, even if we could detect these other chemicals as bombs, you certainly wouldn't describe this material as a bomb. Are there two things you could bring on, or three, that would be innocuous and could be somehow combined to make a bomb?
Well, I suppose in principle you could. In any combustion system, you need some sort of fuel and some sort of oxidant. And so something, and each of those two things are benign in and by themselves. You know, you think about the gasoline that you store in the back of your shed, you know, to mow your grass or something. In and by itself, it's innocuous, I mean, more or less. But, you know, certainly combined with air, it burns and basically powers your mower. In the same way, you know, you could potentially bring in, you know, a separate fuel, which is in and by itself benign, and an oxidizer, and mix it in principle. The thing I'm not so convinced about, though, is that you could do that in an effective way in the context of a plane situation.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly wouldn't want to take, especially if it was sufficiently energetic to blow a hole in the side of an aircraft, you certainly wouldn't want to take these two things and put them in your martini mixer and, you know, shake them or something like that.
I guess you would.
So how would you mix them and do it in a way such that you would get an effective explosive? That's not clear to me.
Yeah. And are these things that you have to ignite some way, or is it enough to slam them against the wall and the force of the impact would get them to go off?
Well, explosives are generally classified as either sensitive or non-sensitive, and that classification denotes how hard you have to basically hit them to ignite them. So a sensitive explosive, if you hit it hard enough, will detonate in and all by itself. You'll actually ignite and burn the mixture. Insensitive explosive will not, and that's all, you know, these are sort of relative terms. And so most explosives, you need a supplemental detonation device, an igniter of some sort.
I got it. Well, let's see what our audience is curious about, and take a call now from Terry in Mankato, Minnesota. Terry, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hello. Thank you for being so prompt with answering me. I was going to ask your guest, and around where I'm from here, there's been some talk of how could you set something off with a cell phone. And it occurs to me, and I just want to ask if I'm correct, it seems to me a cell phone operating on a frequency that it does would be not a whole lot different than a model airplane controller, and could the frequency not actuate a device that in turn would then, you know, set off a spark, you know, in the vapor created, you know, by the liquid, and then there comes your explosion and your ensuing fire, and
Let's see if we can get an answer. Paul Desjardins, does it sound plausible that just a cell phone would be enough to set off this chain of events?
I don't think the frequency from the cell phone in and by itself is the thing that's going to ignite the explosive. Probably the energy source, the battery itself, however, potentially could serve as a source to, you know, as an ignition source, an energy source. But I don't believe, the radio waves, if you will, right from the cell phone directly would be something that could ignite the explosive.
Mm-hmm. Is this, I mean, I'm just curious, is this an area of active investigation? Are there people that are trying to figure out how to make new liquid explosives, or is the things that are out there, as you said earlier on Google, satisfactory for most uses?
Right. Well, certainly the area of explosives and new explosives is an active area of research. And in academia, we look at these things from a very small, level, to look at the fundamental physics of how these devices behave and the associated thermal reactive chemistry about them. In terms of applied devices and things, you know, those in that arena, the Department of Energy, you know, the national laboratories, Department of Defense laboratories, they certainly are always inventing new types of explosives for various applications for whatever suits their needs. So, yes, very much. It's still very much a topic of active research.
Paul Desjardins, thanks very much for talking with us about this today.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Desjardins is an assistant professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at the University of Buffalo. Up next, a look at airport security. Outside of Newark Airport yesterday, passengers stretched out in a line reportedly as long as 6 football fields at one point, as airline screeners scanned carry-on bags for any kind of liquid. Such measures may be warranted, but they also have some people asking whether there isn't a better way to keep us and our airplanes safe. Joining me now to talk more about it is my guest, Michael Barr. He's the director of the University of Southern California's Aviation Safety and Security Programs. He joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Barr.
You're welcome.
So, screening out hair gel, where do we go from here? Is that an efficient thing to do?
Well, I think initially that if they are erring, they're going to err on the conservative side, just like they did after 9/11. And they don't want to be accused, if something would happen, that they didn't take the proper response to what happened. So I think when a situation like 9/11 or yesterday happens, what we'll do is we're going to find almost an overreach as far as corrective actions go. And after a few weeks, we'll start coming back into a more of a normal standard than we have today.
So it does seem as if, you know, each time a threat comes along, it comes as a big surprise, and people start scrambling to figure out a way to counter it. Didn't the 9/11 Commission talk about, you know, getting creative in terms of defenses as trying to anticipate some of these things?
Well, you got to think of the nature of the situation here. The terrorists have the advantage of being the offensive. We have the disadvantage of being on the defensive. In other words, we almost have to react to what they do. And one of the reasons for that is, let's say, just for discussion, that on Monday we kind of thought there could be a problem with gels, and then we made the announcement, even though we didn't know anything that had happened yet, that all liquids and all gels could not come onto an airplane. The outroar of the passengers would be absolutely unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wouldn't happen. The government just wouldn't have put up with, you know, with all the complaints that would come at the airport. So we're just in the disadvantage of almost like a football game where the offense knows where they're going to take the ball and the defense has to try to stop wherever that offense is going to go.
So let's say that you were advising the Transportation Security Administration on a move that would be unpopular but you think would be an effective one. Is there something that that you would advise people to be doing that they're not right now?
Well, that's always a problem, not just in security but in also aviation safety, and that is predicting that something is going to happen. And what we normally do, we do a risk assessment. We look at the risk, the probability of this happening, and if it does happen, what is the severity? Now, what's really difficult is when you come up with a medium to a high risk, and now you try to convince the decision makers that we should spend a lot of money or do a lot of things, because the first question that is always asked you is, how many times has this happened before?
Mm-hmm.
And if you say none, then they kind of look at you kind of funny and say, well, and that's all they say. What they're really saying is, well, let's wait till something happens.
Yeah, but I guess that's a little late, unfortunately.
That's right. That's the nature of the business.
All right. Well, we're going to continue talking about the best way to protect airline travel and things that both the government could possibly do and also what passengers might be thinking about doing in addition to taking their toothpaste and hair gel out of their carry-on bags. So stay with us. We have to take a short break. We're talking this hour about airline safety and security with my guest, Michael Barr. He's the director of University of California's Aviation Safety and Security Program, and you're welcome to join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's take a call now from Robert in Barnesville, Georgia. Welcome to the program.
Hi, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was actually curious about the technology that we have as far as metal detectors and things in the airports, and can they determine the difference between cigarettes being in a pack of cigarettes and explosives being in a pack of cigarettes, and is it plausible for a terrorist to get on a plane or more than one terrorist to come on with something like that and then have enough explosives to actually take down an airplane?
Interesting. Michael Barr?
Well, not being an explosive expert, I'd have to defer to your previous guest on that.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, Paul Desjardins is no longer there, but are there... in the screening, the whole question has come up of, is there any effective method for screening for any kind of explosive right now?
Well, the check baggage is an excellent method of screening for explosives. That's one of the reasons that they want your baggage, most of your items to go through the check baggage, because the majority, the government will not say, TSA will not say the actual percentage of how much of the baggage is actually screened. But the vast majority that are going through explosive screeners before they get onto the airplane.
Okay. Well, that gives us a good sense of that. Let's go now to Carl in Wichita, Kansas. Carl, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show, great topic. I work for a large manufacturer of business aircraft here in the air capital, Wichita, Kansas, and I travel fairly extensively around the country to fix broken airplanes. A lot of my traveling is on the airlines, and I guess what I wanted to comment on was what I consider the TSA being a fairly high price to pay for a false sense of security. I travel with tools and various types of test equipment and such to repair these airplanes that I work on. And frequently I find, the searching to be random as far as people really not knowing what they're looking at. Any number of certain items of test equipment that I take with me on board commercial airliners with a little knowledge and modification, not necessarily with explosives, but things that could be used to seriously disrupt the navigational systems on board the aircraft, things of that nature.
Sure. Well, let's see how Mike Barr responds to that. Has anybody evaluated the effectiveness of TSA and its screening procedures?
Well, one thing to remember that the TSA is really the last defense on these types of terrorist activities. Probably the vast majority, maybe over 95%, to be effective, has to catch it in the intelligence area. If the terrorists have actually got to the airport and are going through screening at that point, we are just almost lucky if we catch it there, because I'm sure they've done dry runs through before. They've tested the system. They know what time to go on. They probably even know certain TSA people on duty, you know, which ones check closer, which ones do not.
Yeah.
This isn't something you just figure out one morning to do. This is looked at for years. In fact, the London group had already done some dry runs in this situation.
But that raises Carl's question, I think, which is, so what are we getting from having this last screening? I mean, it's costing a lot of money.
Well, I think before you get to the airport, one of the things you mentally do is, you know, you take out what's not going to make it through. And as Carl said, there is a sense of security going through when that happens, and they're doing their best, but got to remember, they're the last stopgap before, you know, you get on the airplane. And this is, like we said earlier, this is really a situation where the terrorists are always going to try to be one step ahead. If terrorists can figure out how to take Carl's test equipment and change the frequencies and change all the flight instruments, well, that'll be the new test. And then next week, Carl will not get his equipment on the airplane, except if he checks it.
Yeah. No, I take your point. So it seems as if you were talking about the anticipatory work even before you get to the screening area. And some of that, I know El Al has taken a very aggressive approach with psychological screening. How effective has that been?
I think El Al probably has a truly outstanding program, having gone through it, you know, quite a few times. They'll actually have two people talking to you. One will talk to you. They'll go talk to somebody else. The other person will talk to you. And what they're really looking at the person, you know, and they're experts on judgment of the person. But you got to remember, El Al probably only puts forth 2-3% of all the passengers that fly internationally. And to ask 350 people on a, you know, 747 to do all that, the time that would take would be excessive. Now, you have to remember two things about rules. We can have them very, very, very strict to a point where nobody will fly, and that's not going to be right. We can have them so easy that we have a high risk. That's not going to be right. So it's a constant movement of this acceptable line between convenience and safety that moves all the time. Right now, we're way over to safety. If time goes on, we'll move that line back a little bit more to convenience.
Yeah. All right, let's try another call now and go to, is it Ioana in Mountain View, California? Did I get that right?
Yes, you got it right. Thank you. Good morning. I have a very short question. So we're always discussing about security measures on the passenger area. What about the cargo area? Because it seems that liquid explosive placed in a cargo area could really do a higher damage. So are there security measures enforced there? Most workers, it is my understanding, that have unrestricted access, and most of them didn't have a background check. So what is being done in that area?
Mike Barr?
Well, since the Value Jet crash, one of the big differences has been that you just can't go in and put a box in the cargo of an aircraft.
Maybe you could remind us, what was the Value Jet crash?
The Value Jet is when they put some oxidizers into the cargo hold next to some tires.
Oh, that was just an accident, right?
And that's right. But, you know, it shows that there was hazardous materials inside the airplane that were ignited, and, you know, we lost the airplane. And so as a result of that, before a package can get onto an airplane, it has to go through a certified shipper. And the certified shipper will seal the box, and then they will take it to the cargo company and say, we have checked it, it is secure, and it moves on like that. And as far as the people who work on the ramp, that's probably going to be the next big area, as we found that in Great Britain, one of the alleged terrorists was a ramp worker. And that is, they're going to have to do a very, very strong background check on anybody that has access to airplanes, with everybody from who cleans the airplanes to fuels the airplanes, who draws a tug or a baggage handler. They're going to have to ensure that they have the people's background. They know who they are and what they've done before they've been hired.
Okay, we have time for one more quick question, Mike. And is it Elizabethtown, Kentucky? Is that right?
That's it.
Okay, Mike, what's your question?
To me, it seems that the no shampoo, no deodorant, all this stuff has basically just inconvenienced the passengers. I mean, if I'm a terrorist and I'm going to go on a plane and blow myself up, what's to stop me if they're going to take away my wife's mascara?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously something that size must be a threat, or they wouldn't make you throw it away and shove it in a body cavity or something. I mean, you're going to blow yourself up anyway. Is that our next step, is to get body cavity searches before we fly somewhere on vacation?
Well, I hope it doesn't come to that. But, Michael Barr, do you think that's, I mean, is that where we're headed, or is it going to be a response, you think, to another one of these events if unfortunately one occurs?
No, I don't think they'll go that far, as I said. If you make the level of inconvenience so high, you've just solved the terrorist problem, and nobody's going to fly in the aircraft.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time. Thank you very much for talking with us, Michael Barr.
Thank you.
Michael Barr is director of the University of Southern California's Aviation Safety and Security Programs.